Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Harold Holzer. His latest book is The Civil War and 50 Objects. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I have observed you from a distance over the years, and I don't think I know anyone who's written more books about Abraham Lincoln. Has anyone else written more books than you?
I hope not. I've been trying to set the Guinness record. No, these are written plus edited plus co-authored, and I've worked with some wonderful people as collaborators over the years, Mark Neely and Gabor Borat, principally among them, Frank Williams, Craig Simons, John Y. Simon. So it's not all mine, but I keep plugging away, hoping to get it right someday.
Your new book is The Civil War and 50 Objects, and you've written this in collaboration with the New York Historical Society. We're currently observing 150 years ago the Civil War. We're coming up on the anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg this summer. Mm-hmm. The last few years, we've just seen this outpouring of books on the Civil War. What is it about this conflict that intrigues us and fascinates us all these years later?
Well, it's the only time we let our, our red versus blue tensions become gray versus blue tensions. In other words, the only time we ever decided we couldn't debate and argue out our seemingly intractable regional and political differences. And when there really was a brother against brother outpouring of blood and brutality and changes to the society through the eradication of slavery, I mean, it was so convulsive. If you do the math, and just on casualties alone, if you take today's population, it would be the equivalent of losing 7 million people. I mean, we're properly agonized about 3 deaths in Boston, and 3,000 in New York on 9/11. But this was 750,000, and multiply that by 10 for today's population. This was catastrophic. So we can't forget it, and we shouldn't forget it.
And that also helps us understand why there are so many amazing objects and relics that have been preserved from this conflict. And your book, The Civil War and 50 Objects, has some amazing ones inside it.
Well, this entire project for me was a total accident and a blessing. The Historical Society decided on its own to do this project, and simply asked me if I would be interested. And it's like asking a cat if it would like a saucer of milk. So, that's easy. I didn't have time, but, you make time. And what they did is they invited me to the Historical Society, which is a wonderful, wonderful institution in New York. I'm the Roger Hertog Fellow there in my spare time, which is a wonderful opportunity. And they laid out 60 or 70 objects on a conference room table and a series of other tables in their big old conference room. And they said, come up and look and come up and choose and tell us whether you'd like to write the book. And I said, well, on my way in a taxi, I thought, they're going to have some New York objects, and I'm not sure there's a book there. And, this is a bigger story than New York. And you know how hard it is for a New Yorker to say that, right? But I got there, and I was completely blown away by what they had. They had things from the South. They had Confederate flags. They had letters from New Yorkers who favored the Confederacy. They had one of the pikes that John Brown and his men used in the raid against Harper's Ferry. They had Lincoln material that not only I'd never seen, but that I never knew existed. They had a copy made on a sort of a carbon paper device made at Appomattox by Ulysses S. Grant's aide, Colonel Eli Parker. They had a petition calling on Lincoln to free the slaves before he was ready to do so that has the names of thousands of people on it, a big scroll. And they were absolutely right. This is a way to tell the whole story from slavery through Sumter, through the battles, the great battles, including Gettysburg, to the final eradication of slavery and the assassination just through what they own. And it's astonishing. So it flowed easily, and I hope people like the result.
The book is The Civil War in 50 Objects. Harold Holzer joins us. It was simmering. It was building up the pressure in the 1840s, 1850s, all these arguments about mm-hmm. slavery and other issues. And you just mentioned the weapon of last resort. John Brown, he threw gasoline on the fire at Harper's Ferry, and this pike is an amazing artifact.
It is, because it's almost as if several things. I mean, first of all, he's sort of recognizing that the quest for freedom is almost going to be a primal kind of an effort, that if people have to use spears and sticks and rocks, they're going to fight for their own freedom. And it also suggests, you know, that he acknowledged or realized that enslaved people had been denied so many opportunities to learn, to marry, and certainly to use weapons, that he was going to have to supply weapons, but they were going to have to be almost medieval kind of weapons, because he didn't think African Americans would ever be able to shoulder a rifle. That he didn't live to see that proven wrong, and it only took four years after his raid for that to happen, and for African Americans to prove that they could fight every bit as well with guns as white people. But it's an amazing statement for that moment. It's chilling.
Osawatomie Brown,
yeah.
What an amazing man. I've been watching a sculptor at work recently, and I was particularly intrigued by your chapter about the animal himself.
Right.
That's quite a story, and these sculptures, what would you call it, a life mask?
Mask and cast of hands, and of course we're talking about Abraham Lincoln. Who else would describe himself as the animal himself?
What is it about you and Lincoln? What?
I don't know. He's been a good friend to me for 40 years. He's put my kids through college, helped me buy a home, so I credit him with being my guiding star through all my years. But beyond giving me a wonderful avocation, a second career, he's been endlessly intriguing to me, because in every phase of work that I do on history, he emerges as the person who sets the gold standard. When I wrote only about images, sculptures and paintings and prints and photographs, he was the most photographed, the most portrayed, and yet the person who made fun of his own appearance and was clever enough to use all the new technologies to spread that appearance around the country.
Mm.
When I began writing about speeches and words, it was evident that, as it's been evident to people for generations, that he was not only a great presidential writer, but one of the greatest writers of the 19th century in any medium, with just a brilliant mastery of the English language, and influential in changing the way politicians speak, from this grandiloquent kind of purple prose to a kind of elemental simplicity that set the stage for Hemingway and others who spoke in ways people could understand. In politics, you know, and I worked in politics for years also as my principal profession. His patience and his, I don't want to say scheming, because it sounds like a pejorative term, but his planning are the most brilliant examples of political mastery, I think, in American history. So he's my guy, and there's still more to do. I'm working on a project now that is, you know, it's always about the next one.
Mm.
So I'm already working on a book about, well, I'm almost done with a book about Lincoln and the press of the 19th century.
Uh-huh.
And this sort of puts it all together for me, because I've, you know, once was a journalist and have been a public relations person for a long time. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. We're talking about the Civil War and 50 objects, I guess.
You alluded to your former career in politics. You worked in the administration of Governor Mario Cuomo.
I did.
And we had him on this show once upon a time.
Really?
He's an amazing guy.
He is brilliant. And he got me involved in a project that turned out to be probably the best-selling and most wonderful Lincoln project I ever worked on, and that's Lincoln on Democracy. He had a visit from the Solidarity Teachers of Poland, just as Poland was emerging as a, you know, out of the Iron Curtain. And he was told by these teachers that they had no Lincoln to teach their children, that the communists had removed the books and in the 1940s, and could he help? And he said, yes, I'll give you a book on Lincoln. And then he called me up and said, give me a book on Lincoln. And we collaborated on this project, and it's been translated into Japanese and Hebrew and Indonesian, and it's spread Lincoln's great words all over the world, words about freedom and equality and representative government and freedom. So it's a great project, and he's a great man, and good to see him thriving, and good to see him having the joy of having a son in, as governor of New York.
Yeah, I interviewed him for a children's book that he wrote.
I know that book well.
Yeah.
I've seen that tree in my time. So I knew Mario Cuomo when he was before he was governor, when he was running for mayor in 1977, and the famous blue spruce that his father made his son help him save in a rainstorm, still standing in Queens in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a great story. I'm glad he did a children's book of that, because he was certainly, at least it got him to stop telling the story all the time, because now he could just say, read the book.
Well, I still can't believe that he agreed to do an interview, but he was wonderful. And
well, he is not only wonderful talking about his own past and an American past, because he's a great student of history. Happily for me, his sister gave him the collected works of Abraham Lincoln when he was a young man, and it really influenced him.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about Mario Cuomo is that he's still a great political philosopher, and he still has views about government and about our obligations to our fellow Americans as citizens that are still important, and I'm glad he's still expressing them.
Harold Holzer joins us. The book is The Civil War in 50 Objects. A few moments ago, you mentioned the conflict between the red and the blue, or the gray and the blue. And when you said red, it reminded me of the fact that during the Revolutionary War, the red coats, as the British soldiers were called, were so easy to spot on the battlefield because of their red coats. And you would think that that would have been a lesson for us. But in the Civil War, we have these outrageously flamboyant uniforms, and one of them is in the collection of the New York Historical Society. And I love the story about these crazy guys that went out in these wild uniforms.
Well, of course, you're talking about the Zouaves, who were modeled after sort of French Foreign Legion soldiers, wearing red coats with gold braids and fezes with tassels and puffy pants with stockings. Now, looking at those, you know, thinking of a soldier in that today, it looks like a, you know, a Keystone Cops movie or somebody who got loose guarding a harem. And it's almost, and you wouldn't think that these were the toughest guys that dressed so flamboyantly. And but in those days, they were like the Marines. Of course, they were Marines, but not like today's Marines. But these guys were fearsome, and they were considered the roughest fighters. There was a young man named Elmer Ellsworth, who lived in upstate New York, who formed this very well-received drill team that used to do demonstrations on stage and in arenas and in outdoor settings around the country. And all these guys with their big baggy pants and their funny shoes and belts and would run around in circles and then suddenly drop to their knees and click their guns and run up and jump up. It was sort of like gymnastics, or gymnastics, as my grandson calls it, and rifle-toting. And they were really popular. And so he formed a Zouave unit early in the war, and then he was killed before the war really got underway at Bull Run.
Wasn't this the fellow who didn't like the flag across
it's
the
exactly
river?
Exactly the fellow. and that flag still exists, by the way. I didn't know it, but I found out earlier this year that New York State actually owns that flag.
And he was the first casualty, wasn't he?
He was the first Union casualty.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We don't know if there are any Confederate casualties. Well, let's put it this way. He was the first Union officer killed in the war.
Okay.
So I don't think people make claims about, you know, what happened. There were people killed, after all, in the firing on the Massachusetts Regiment in Baltimore.
Uh-huh.
So few people died, but Ellsworth was an officer and was shot by a man named Jackson, who was a relative of the future Stonewall Jackson. Uh-huh. All the stories interconnect. So the Historical Society has a complete get-up, a complete Zouave uniform, proudly decorated. You know, when I grew up, this is the way ushers in movie theaters dress. So you just can't imagine. And of course, these guys stood out on the battlefield, as you point out. They were targets. They didn't care because it was a matter of pride.
And Ellsworth was a particular favorite of the Lincoln family. Wasn't he on the train that Lincoln took to his inauguration?
He was on all the trains. There was a series of trains. Yes, he was part of the elite unit that guarded Lincoln. Lincoln was very fond of him. He was a red law in his office, so he was sort of a law student, a mentee of Lincoln. And, you know, we're telling the story in sections here, but working at the or visiting the White House, he saw this flag through his spyglass across the Potomac River in Alexandria flying on a hotel, and he decided it was an insult to his friend President Lincoln, and that's when he took his troops across the river to pull it down. Hmm. And, you know, the story was interesting, and it's a beautiful story. But you always wondered, what kind of a monster flag would be that evident? And then here we are in New York State, and I'm invited to this exhibit in Governor Andrew Cuomo's state capitol. And there's the flag.
Oh, my.
Most of it. People ripped a lot of pieces off as souvenirs. Huh. It's got an Alexandria, Virginia cloth maker's name sewn in it, and it is gigantic.
Wow.
It is, the stories are not exaggerated. This would have been visible from the White House with an ordinary telescope or binoculars.
Another one of the objects in the book is this beautiful little drum that belonged to a drummer boy.
And it gives me the opportunity, as I try to do in each chapter about an object, is not just talk about the specifics of the object, but the genre, to be use a fancy term, the nature of the relic as it impacted in many variations on the theme through the war. And of course, drums were important. They, in the smoke of battle, you see movies of battles in so many films, and you don't really see the smoke and the dust, and all you see are soldiers moving toward each other. Well, the fact is, in many instances, they didn't see each other. There was so much smoke and so much dust that they had no visibility. Those drum taps were not simply rhythmic diversions. They would direct people to retreat or to move in different directions. And the people who used them were boys. The youngest recruits were drummers, musicians. Hmm. They also woke people up at reveille, and they weren't very popular. They were not treated well by the soldiers.
Oh, my.
And there are a lot of surviving drums, but to have one gives us the opportunity to remind people that this was a children's war, too. And a lot of those boys, 11, 12, 15, 16, never came back. They also, when they weren't drumming, they were the detail that carried bodies and wounded people back toward the hospital lines. So they had a pretty violent transition into premature adulthood in that experience. And we don't know enough about that. That's a subject that really needs more study. I'm glad we have an example in the book.
A lot of what we do know comes from diaries written by soldiers. And, mm-hmm. and there's a diary in the collection by a soldier who mysteriously stopped writing a couple months before he died in battle.
Yeah, it's not very dramatic duty that he's describing. It's coastal duty in the Carolinas, but he sees things, he sees battles, he sees black people about whom he's sort of disdainful. He talks about life in camp, he talks about the heat, he talks about officers who are pains in the neck. It's very revealing. Who is he writing for? Why did he stop? Where did he get the book? Those are things we'll never know. It is extraordinary how many soldiers did make their impressions, record their impressions in their own little books. Sort of the tweeting of the 19th century. Thank goodness somebody did it. And the Historical Society owns quite a few of them. This one seemed the most compelling.
And when we think about all the people who died and all the battles. We don't often think about all the souvenirs, but they have collections of Confederate buttons that were clearly collected by souvenir hunters, and it's almost kind of gruesome to imagine what lengths people were going to obtain souvenirs.
It is gruesome, isn't it? All you see are buttons sort of sewn crudely to index cards, but they represent two facets of collecting that are pretty horrible. One is really grave robbing, I mean, just plucking things off dead people. And the other examples that we know about are taken from prisoners in return for, you know, a cup of coffee or a drink of water. These avaricious collectors wanted examples of regimental buttons and nice brass and things like that, so they offered in return what imprisoned or starving people were desperate for. And an example of that kind of desperation, I think, is evident in another, you know, fabulous item, and that's something called well, there are a lot of newspaper things in this book, but the Prison Times is one of my favorites. It's a newspaper created by some very bored and very creative people in a Union prison camp. Just brilliant writing about, you know, where to find leisure, where to find prayers, where to find apples. And they only did one newspaper because it probably took so long to do. And then the camp was liberated. The war ended. But it's a really useful, gossipy kind of newspaper. And, of course, it wasn't printed because they didn't have a printing press. So they made a couple of copies and passed it around from bunk to bunk. And, you know, the appetite for information doesn't wither even in circumstances that we can't imagine. So I found that, you know, as a newspaper lover to be quite an interesting piece.
The book is The Civil War in 50 Objects. Harold Holzer joins us. Newspapers. You are working on a book about Lincoln's relations with the press, and I'm guessing there's going to be a lot in there about that New York newspaper that has this outrageous editorial cartoon, which is in this new book.
You have to remind me which one.
The one where they're having a ball, the
miscegenation ball. Yeah, you know, it wasn't in the newspaper. In Lincoln's era, there weren't many illustrations in newspapers except in the illustrated newspapers. And we do have an example of that in the book, this great drawing that was made of Jefferson Davis's own slaves fleeing from his Mississippi plantation as soon as they heard that Grant's forces were near Vicksburg. But the item you're referring to is a cartoon that was created for the 1864 presidential campaign.
Oh, okay.
And it was a separate display piece. If you could imagine someone displaying what was considered to be a horrific scene. It's supposed to show a multiracial cotillion. So black men are dancing with white women. That's supposed to send, you know, shivers of anger and fear and hatred into the minds of white men. What made it unusual, aside from the fact that it's so racist and so ludicrous, is the fact that in those days, cartoons were published by entrepreneurs, not by politicians, not by press, and not by partisans. It was all just part of the natural economy that attached itself to politics, unlike newspapers, who were very partisan. Well, what happened here is that the anti-Lincoln paper, the New York World, commissioned this print directly as a dirty trick to use against Lincoln. And the libel was supposed to be that Republicans who supported Lincoln went to a mixed race prom or something. So, you know, New York was a tough and very racist town in those days, and they did not vote for Lincoln, needless to say. Remember, this is the city of the draft riots, and New York, that is, and the Historical Society has the most extraordinary archive about that awful time. And, you know, they're called the draft riots, but they were really race riots. It started because of the draft, but the idea behind them, and this is right after Gettysburg, is that white draftees did not want to fight to free black people and did not want black people to come to New York as free people to compete with them for the jobs that they held.
Hmm.
Not much has changed. Now it's the immigration debate. But the Historical Society has the records. Well, it has the a draft wheel with draft cards still in it.
Wow.
That were never removed. That's in the book. The most chilling relic maybe in the whole book is a Bible that was used in the so-called Colored Orphans Asylum, which stood, for those of your listeners who know New York, right around where the New York Public Library is today on Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street. And it was a beautiful building, and it was torched by the rioters, even with the kids still inside.
Oh, no.
And the people inside said, just be brave and walk with us. And they got everybody out, took them to a police station, and got them to safety on what is now Roosevelt Island. But this Bible was charred before the fire was put out. And that is a really chilling reminder of something that might have turned into one of the most ugly scenes of mass murder in the history of this country.
My guest has been Harold Holzer. His book is The Civil War in 50 Objects. And Harold, you must be extraordinary with time management, because here you've written over 40 books and you have your day job.
I do have my day job. I'm speaking to you during my lunch hour of my day job at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where I've been lucky enough to serve as a chief press and marketing officer for more than 20 years. But happily for me, this has always been a place that reveres scholarship. And, you know, while obviously my first obligation is always to them, that they've been understanding, encouraging, and wonderful to me over the years as I pursue this avocation. And last night I did a performance called Lincoln's Shakespeare in town.
Oh.
And we had two tables filled with my Met friends, so they've been very supportive. It was an interesting program. April 22nd is Shakespeare's birthday, according to tradition. So to mark the event, we assembled four actors, and I did the narration, weaving together Lincoln's love for Shakespeare and then having them perform the soliloquies that made him laugh and made him cry over the years. Just to hear what Lincoln heard is amazing. And Lincoln's admonition was always read things aloud. Don't just read things. So if anyone wants to read The Civil War in 50 Objects aloud, I think it would be very Lincoln-esque. Not a great bedtime book, but very Lincoln-esque.
Well, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My guest today has been Harold Holzer. The book is The Civil War in 50 Objects. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic Mekunis. Tune in next week for another interview with one of my favorite writers, Verlin Klinkenborg. His new book is More Scenes from the Rural Life in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.